I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Frances Haugen, former Facebook data scientist turned whistleblower, gave a trove of company documents to the Wall Street Journal, was interviewed on 60 Minutes this past Sunday, and testified before the Senate Commerce Subcommittee on Consumer Protection on Tuesday. And what she said about the giant social network was damning, accusing it of moral bankruptcy, knowing its product was harmful and not doing enough to fix it. Here's a short clip from her testimony.
But I'm here today because I believe Facebook's products harm children, stoke division, and weaken our democracy. The company's leadership knows how to make Facebook and Instagram safer, but won't make the necessary changes because they have put their astronomical profits before people. I saw Facebook repeatedly encounter conflicts between its own profits and our safety. Facebook consistently resolved these conflicts in favor of its own profits. The result has been more division, more harm, more lies, more threats, and more combat. In some cases, this dangerous online talk has led to actual violence that harms and even kills people.
CEO Mark Zuckerberg pushed back, saying it's not true that the company puts profits before people. Facebook has nearly 3 billion users worldwide, and the company includes Instagram and WhatsApp. Radio Times has a Facebook page. Today, what we learned about Facebook, how it keeps users engaged, how it feeds dis and misinformation, and whether and how it can be reformed. And we begin with Cecilia Kang. She is New York Times reporter covering the Senate hearing, co-author of a book titled An Ugly Truth, Inside Facebook's Battle for Domination. Cecilia Kang, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Very happy to be here.
Would you say that Frances Haugen's testimony and even her interview on 60 Minutes could be a game changer for Facebook?
I absolutely think that Frances Haugen's testimony and the trove of information that she obtained in terms of research memos and emails from within Facebook and that she's brought to the public and through the Wall Street Journal and their series of stories has absolutely jolted the public into recognizing something that they sort of suspected before, but her documents seem to prove, which is that there has long been a feeling that the company is not necessarily great for teens when it comes to Instagram. They don't feel great on it. I think anecdotally, many parents feel that way. That was part of the research that she brought forward. But in terms of the business model, and I think this was the most revealing thing, I think she put a lot of attention on how the business actually works and how the company's technology and business is focused on getting people to engage more and more and more, and that the cost of that has often been the stoking of harmful and sometimes toxic speech.
And I want to get to all that. Would you say her testimony on Tuesday, did it jolt, to use your words, did it jolt the senators?
Yes, what it did was, which was pretty extraordinary in my mind, because I've been following so many Facebook hearings over the years, is it united Democrats and Republicans in a feeling that they absolutely need to act, that change would not come from Facebook internally, and that there, despite years of trying to introduce legislation related to data privacy and security for the tech sector, they have failed. And this is a time when they actually have to focus more on it. Again, this is members of Congress who've said these things before. But the thing that was different to me is that the members of Congress in that subcommittee were speaking about Facebook's technology and business model in a much more sophisticated manner than I have heard before. They were talking about ranking systems and algorithms and how, as according to Frances Haugen, the whistleblower, those algorithms are geared at getting more and more attention, more and more usage, often at the cost of safety and the spread of misinformation. And that sort of focus and level of conversation, not just on whether there is bad speech online and or whether there's censorship by Facebook, but on the system itself, was new and I think really pushed the conversation forward.
I was going to ask you about that because there have been hearings in the past where you feel like the members of Congress who are questioning people like Mark Zuckerberg and others, that they don't know what they're talking about. But it sounds they did, they did their homework, and they do know what they're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to say they've completely got it, but I mean, we've come a long way from Senator Orrin Hatch asking Facebook how it makes money. And I should say, I think that he's been unfairly, like, his comments, you know, how do you make money are taken out of context. I think he was saying that to get Facebook to Mark Zuckerberg to explain the business model some more. But the point being is that that became sort of an internet meme because Mark Zuckerberg said, Senator, we sell ads, in sort of a glib manner. And I think that that was seen as like the best example of Congress's lack of technology knowledge, going up against these technology companies that are just moving so quickly and advancing their technology, and this feeling that the gulf or the delta between Washington and Silicon Valley is just too big and too wide. But I think that what we saw this week is that things that gap is narrowing in terms of technology knowledge, and that legislation may be considered in a way where they're really looking specifically at sort of the belly of the beast of these companies, if you will, the technology and how they function.
Well, let me have you explain. I want to make sure our listeners understand how a company like Facebook functions.
Sure.
And as I said in my introduction, you know, 3 billion users in the world. I think there are 8 billion people. So we're talking about 40% of the world's population. We should know how this works, especially how these algorithms work. Is there a short, quick, down and dirty answer to that question, Cecilia?
Yeah, I think the easiest way to understand this is that Facebook has designed its systems to pick up on the kind of content that you like, that you comment on, that you put emojis next to, and that you share. And the more time you do those kinds of things, when you have that kind of engagement, the more popular that content continues to be, and the more likely that content will rise to the top of news feeds. And what's happened is that that kind of content that people tend to engage with the most is often the most agitating content. It's a kind of, whether it's positive agitation or negative agitation, like fear or happiness. And it's not the nuance sort of the feeling that people have and that causes them not to actually do anything. And that actually is ripe, though those conditions are ripe for the spread of misinformation, hateful content, and harmful content. And that is sort of the problem. And the best example is, and this was brought up in the hearing, is if a teenage girl on Instagram expresses or shares a story about wanting to have a healthier lifestyle related to fitness and eating, what will happen is Facebook's algorithms have, and these are real examples brought forth by the documents by Frances Haugen and by anecdotal testimony that members of Congress brought up, that teenage girl will be pushed into more content that's related to extreme fitness, extreme dieting, then potentially eating disorders and self-harm. That's the kind of dangerous rabbit hole that Facebook's algorithms are sort of designed to do, is to get you to go deeper into the most agitating content that can oftentimes be the most destructive kind of content.
Is that because the goal is to keep whoever that user is, whether they're a teenage girl or someone older or a male, is to keep them engaged?
That's the whole business. You know, the whole business is engagement. The way Facebook makes money is it collects data to sell to advertisers. And advertisers then take that data about you as a user, and they know that, okay, well, or myself, Cecilia, lives in such a city, and she is of this age group, and she has expressed interest in this kind of music and this kind of, you know, political, like, you know, cause. Then the advertiser can sell ads to target ads directly to me based on that. That data is only available if I spend a lot of time on Facebook. And when I spend a lot of time on Facebook and I tell basically Facebook what I'm interested in by the kind of engagement that I have on the site, then that's how the whole machinery of Facebook, the business model, works. So Facebook needs you absolutely to be engaged online. And also, Facebook doesn't want to be irrelevant. It wants to be the center of conversation in general. So they will always prioritize more engagement, more use, more attention. And that's that's sort of the secret sauce of their success.
Well, and what she also was saying, this is Frances Haugen, the whistleblower, is that Facebook knows this and knows that it can spread misinformation or disinformation or information that's harmful to users, but hasn't done enough to address the problem.
Yes, in many cases, hasn't done enough to address the problem. In our book, we talk about how they ignore warnings by the security team as related to Russian interference in 2016. And we have another anecdote of how not only do they sometimes ignore or they don't do enough, but they prioritize engagement. And the best example we have is after, or one of the many examples that we have in our book, is after the 2020 presidential election in the U.S., Facebook was really afraid that election misinformation was spreading too rampantly. They were seeing that. They were seeing the widespread of the Stop the Steal movement that was a lot of Trump supporters were spreading. And so what they did was they changed the algorithms to prioritize authoritative news, such as NPR, The New York Times, CNN, et cetera, Wall Street Journal. And what they found is that some of that misinformation was clamped down, and that also engagement went down. So after several days, even though better information or more authoritative information was more prevalent, they decided to crank the levers again back toward a different kind of algorithm that deprioritized the authoritative news. So not only do they know, but they are twisting the dials, if you will. I know I'm mixing metaphors, but
yeah,
they're twisting the dials over and over in different ways that suits their goal for engagement. And I think that the company is very defensive about like this idea that they choose profits over safety. And I actually would argue that it's a little bit more nuanced. It's more about the company is so data-driven. It's so driven towards these engagement figures, these ranking systems that try to get you to engage more and more, and the time spent on the site and how much you actually click and like and comment, that the consequence of that oftentimes is that users are less safe, disinformation and harmful content is spread. I think that what they recoil at and what they're very defensive at is this idea that their motive is to harm people. What I think our book does, and I think that what the whistleblower is finding, and as well as reporting by so many other great reporters, is that decisions over and over, no matter what the motive is, result in the same thing, which is a lot of disinformation, a lot of harmful content.
We're almost out of time with you, but just very quickly, is Zuckerberg going to appear before this committee? Do you know?
Well, Senator Blumenthal, the chair of the subcommittee for consumer protection in the Senate, did tell me that he will. He thinks it's appropriate to call Mark Zuckerberg back. I will say, though, I've sort of seen that show before. I'm not quite sure what he will do, how valuable that is, except that now, because Frances Haugen, if you will, brought the receipts, he may need to, on the record, what Blumenthal may be wanting to do is to get Mark Zuckerberg on the record to actually explain what he knew and what he didn't know. And I think a lot of legal action after that can occur.
We have to leave it there. Cecilia Kang, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Just said goodbye to Cecilia Kang. She's a reporter for The New York Times. Also co-author of a book called An Ugly Truth Inside Facebook's Battle for Domination. And we were talking about Facebook whistleblower Frances Haugen. She did testify before a Senate subcommittee on Tuesday. She was featured on 60 Minutes on Sunday, and she also leaked a series of pretty damning documents to the Wall Street Journal all about Facebook. We're going to talk about what we are learning about this company, some of the problematic policies and decisions and algorithms, impact on users, our democracy, and if oversight regulation is the answer. Joining us now is Nate Persily, joining us by Skype. He's a professor of law at Stanford Law School, co-director of the Stanford MIT Healthy Elections Project, also director of the Stanford Cyber Policy Center. Nate, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Robin Kaplan, and she's senior researcher at Data and Society. Robin, nice to have you with us as well.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, we want to make sure that you can join our conversation. We are talking about Facebook today. And as I said in my introduction, we have a Facebook page here at Radio Times. We want to hear from you about how you use it and what you think about all this information that we're learning about its algorithms and how it keeps people engaged and perhaps some of the downside and some of the upside as well. Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Nate, I'll put this to you, but Robin, I want to hear from you as well. And it's essentially where I began with Cecilia Kang, which is looking at the 60 Minutes, the Wall Street Journal, and now this testimony before a Senate subcommittee. Nate, do you think things are turning for Facebook?
Well, I think that Cecilia mentioned the significant fact, which it looks like Democrats and Republicans see some area for bipartisan compromise when it comes to tech regulation. There's still a long road to hoe there, but that was the thing that kind of was signaled there. Also, Frances Haugen was such an effective witness because, as Cecilia mentioned, she did bring the receipts, right?
Yes.
So that we had a window onto some of the internal Facebook research that we haven't seen before. And so I do think that, the tide is turning, but it's just as hard as it always has been for Congress to pass anything in the tech realm or elsewhere.
To you, Robin, what do you think was the most important / damning thing that Frances Haugen said?
So for anybody who's been paying attention for these last few years, none of these documents were particularly surprising. To answer your first question, I think the major issue is that we are starting to see a little bit more agreement that tech regulation needs to happen. There's still a significant amount of disagreement about what the problems are specifically, and that will obviously impact what solutions lawmakers are seeking. What I saw as really the most damning was just this continued ignoring of people who are working for the company, people who are raising problems to executives within the company and being ignored.
And she obviously came forward in a pretty bold and dramatic way, Robin.
Right, she did. And we know, researchers know who have been speaking with people at these companies for years, that there's a lot of good people in these companies that have been doing this work. So it did reach a bit of a fever pitch moment where everything kind of was released to the public. But some of these problems have been well known for a long time now.
Well, going to you, Nate, and then I do want to play another clip from the testimony, but going to you, you were co-chair of an outside group to get Facebook to share data with researchers. You quit. Why?
Well, I still have very close relationships with people at Facebook. The people inside who we worked with were very diligent in trying to do the right thing. And that's one of the things that's come out of these hearings is that, Facebook is a they, not an it, even though it is run, to some extent like a monarchy. There are lots of different factions inside. The social science one, the effort that I and Gary King at Harvard started was trying to get Facebook to share data with outside researchers. But very quickly, when we started about 3-4 years ago, we ran into problems about how to do that in a safe, secure, privacy-protected way. Because at the same time that we were trying to get them to share data, there was the specter of Cambridge Analytica, which was the incidence of a Cambridge researcher getting some private data and using it for a political consulting firm. And so we were stymied right from the outset of trying to get all the data that we would want, which is one of the reasons why we need Congress to step in to mandate, that Facebook and Google and the other companies provide data in a safe, secure, privacy-protected way.
So that we can know more about what they're doing?
That's right. Yeah, I think one of the if the dam is going to break because of this testimony, it's about forcing these companies to engage in more disclosure and to have outside, some kind of outside independent group monitor their algorithms and understand the data that people like Frances Haugen had access to. Because I think Robin Kaplan's right, which is that there, for those of us who've been watching Facebook, these disclosures were not all that new. But what is new is to get a sense of the sort of richness of the data that they're analyzing inside, and how much of a monopoly they have on that data, right? That those of us on the outside who really want to understand what's happening on the platform are pretty much sort of shooting in the dark.
Well, let me play another clip from the hearing, and then Robin Kaplan, I want to get a response from you. This is committee member Senator Brian Schatz of Hawaii. He's a Democrat, asking Frances Haugen about whether Facebook would stop developing Instagram Kids. Facebook announced last week that it was pausing its work on the new app after growing public concern about the platform's harmful impact on teen mental health. It's a minute. Let's give it a quick listen.
Do you believe that they're actually going to discontinue Instagram Kids, or are they just waiting for the dust to settle?
I would be sincerely surprised if they do not continue working on Instagram Kids, and I would be amazed if a year from now we don't have this conversation again.
Why?
Facebook understands that if they want to continue to grow, they have to find new users. They have to make sure that the next generation is just as engaged with Instagram as the current one. And the way they'll do that is by making sure that children establish habits before they have good self-regulation.
By hooking kids.
I would like to emphasize one of the documents that we sent in on problematic use examined the rates of problematic use by age, and that peaked with 14-year-olds. It's just like cigarettes. Teenagers don't have good self-regulation. They say explicitly, I feel bad when I use Instagram, and yet I can't stop. We need to protect the kids.
And Robin, she's talking about largely teenage girls there. Is Facebook like tobacco?
This is such a hard question.
Isn't it? but an important one, because, I mean, in the last couple of days, that's what's being tossed around.
It is. I mean, so anybody who studies media studies would say, you know, it's really hard to make the case that media is itself addictive. We've seen problems with media in the past with teen mental health in almost every generation of media. So things like MTV and 17 were also very bad for teen mental health. At the same time, you know, this is a moment where we can talk about how can new technologies do things differently. And one of the main concerns with them expanding into these new spaces is that they haven't actually given the resources to serve the users that are already on their platform. So that was another one of the kind of things that we learned from these disclosures that, again, if you've been paying attention, you already knew, was that they aren't able to serve people in every language. They don't have offices everywhere that they're operating. So we need to make sure that they're able to serve the people that they are already serving. And that is billions of people right now before they start expanding into new areas.
I'm looking actually at a report that NPR did. So I'm quoting from NPR, who's quoting from somebody else, but I'll put this to you, Nate. And they raised some questions about some of the research that came out about teenage girls' use of Facebook, raising questions about really what the studies revealed, quoting a Candace Odgers, psychologist who studies adolescents at the University of California. She said, if you ask teens if they are addicted or harmed by social media or their phones, the vast majority say yes. But if you actually do the research and connect their use to objective measures, there's very little connection there.
Yeah, that is true. I think that, you know, there's a lot of contestation about what something like Instagram shows for, you know, the average user. But one of the things that came out, and the studies that were revealed were very, what we say, small N studies, the ones that inside surveys done of a very small number of teens. But fundamentally, you know, if you have a photo sharing app, right, that allows young people to show themselves to their friends, you are going to have some of these problems, right? Some of these problems I'm worried are actually endemic to the platform or any other similar platform that allows for kind of the social part of social media. And, you know, when it comes to Instagram Kids, you know, Instagram has a problem, which is that kids are going to lie about their age and get Instagram accounts. And so part of what they were trying to do with Instagram Kids was to create a separate pathway for young people. And none of the platforms have really sort of figured out How to, on the one hand, preserve the anonymity and the distance that is critical to the, you know, the functioning of these platforms, and then to check the age of everybody who would be coming onto the platform.
Well, and Robin, you and I were teenage girls once, and so I certainly know how to feel bad about myself and my body as a young teenage girl. And you mentioned 17 magazine, and you know all the comic books and things that I certainly grew up on. But I didn't spend 5 and 6 and 7 hours scrolling through that stuff. And I wonder if there's something about Facebook or even just social media that keeps young people engaged in a really intense and personal way.
I keep on saying that, you know, the patriarchy existed pre-internet. That is not something new, and that is always going to be something that comes through with all media. But Nate is right. So these studies are actually pretty small. There are other studies that have emerged. There was one by Project Awesome at University of Amsterdam that showed that a small percentage of teens experienced negative effects on their subjective well-being after spending time on social media platforms. But it was about 10% of users. So those are the users that we really need to be focusing on when we have these kinds of concerns. But yeah, I was a teen as well. And I did spend a significant amount of my time watching television. So I think that, you know.
And feeling bad.
And feeling bad,
that you didn't look like whoever.
Of course, the 2000s was not a good year for women and how they were portrayed weight-wise. So I understand the concerns, and I do think that this is a moment to try and be better. I think we should always be striving to be better. But I'm not certain those numbers are telling the whole story.
I mean, Nate,
Can I just add one thing?
Yeah, please do.
Which is that, and this, I just want to emphasize the point Robin was making, which is that for most of the pathologies, on Facebook are on online behavior. This is a familiar dynamic, which is that it is a big problem for a minority of users, right? So whether you're talking about depression or you're talking the prevalence of hate speech or other kinds of rabbit holes on the internet, it's not that the average user is subjected to this. Most people, when they're on Facebook, for instance, it's just sort of meaningless social interactions between different people. It's not that they are being drawn into a QAnon conspiracy world or something like that. But that's the problem, which is that there are a, you know, not insignificant, but even if still a minority of users who are experiencing all of these problems that she revealed.
Right. And these are serious problems. But picking up on that, and Robin, let me go back to you. I mean, is it possible to create, I don't know if we're talking about algorithms here, but something that can protect those people who are vulnerable to these kinds of messages?
I mean, again, I just think we need more information here. So, like, we need more studies that are being done on this. We need to see more studies about what is helpful for teen health on these platforms, because they are going to be on them. There's no, unfortunately, putting the genie back in the bottle in the sense it is. Social media is here. Teens are using it. And it is important to kind of consider how we could make their lives better on these platforms. At the same time, we don't want platforms just to be investing in things that are performative. So my colleague Amanda Lenhart has done a significant amount of work on teens and mental health on platforms. And one of her findings was that, you know, Facebook tested out a feature that they thought would help teen well-being, and that was removing likes. They found out that it didn't actually help teen well-being, but they rolled it out anyways because they wanted to kind of create that performance of helping out in this particular area. So we need more research. We need more access to that data. We always need more access. I'm a researcher, so I'm always going to say that. But before we can make any sort of big decisions.
Sure, fair enough. Let me go back to Frances Haugen again, testifying to the Subcommittee on Consumer Protection. And this is about Facebook and about how she thinks it needs to change. Let's give it a quick listen.
The documents I have provided to Congress prove that Facebook has repeatedly misled the public about what its own research reveals about the safety of children, the efficacy of its artificial intelligence systems, and its role in spreading divisive and extreme messages. As long as Facebook is operating in the shadows, hiding its research from public scrutiny, it is unaccountable. Until the incentives change, Facebook will not change.
Do you agree with that, Nate?
Well, I actually think the problems are even deeper than the business model, though the business model is part of it. I think, you know, I deal a lot with the content moderation folks at Facebook, and I think that to some extent, right, if you are going to be running a social media company where you're trying to give users communication and information and content that they have revealed preferences for, right, that is a prescription for essentially giving them all the dessert they want, sure, right, without giving them their vitamins, right, or their vegetables. And that, I think, is the core problem here. And I think Cecilia Kang was suggesting that before. It's not that they've set out to cause these problems. It's just that if you give people what they want, well, then a lot of what they want is not healthy behavior or healthy content.
Well, and back to you, Robin. I mean, Facebook is so many things, and it's a place where a lot of people get their news. And we have, you know, we have regulation and guidelines for how news companies are supposed to operate. Does that in any way address what we're talking about or just confuse the matter?
No, I think it really does. So I wrote a paper a long time ago called Why Media Companies Insist They're Not Media Companies, Why They're Wrong and Why That Matters. And it was really about Facebook. It was a terrible title, well, a long title at least. And it was about, you know, the different ways that they are acting like a media company and how we need to start holding them to similar standards. And there isn't a significant amount of regulation around news, but there is a lot of kind of professional standards that have developed over the years that help kind of address this problem. And we are starting to see Facebook move into some of those public interest directions. So we saw it with COVID-19. We've seen it with the election in the US. We saw it with census. They are trying to move into the direction of saying, oh, okay, well, we can prioritize authoritative or official information, particularly when, you know, the public health is at stake, public integrity is at stake. So they are starting to kind of semi-define what that means, but it isn't solving all problems on these platforms either. So it's not a silver bullet.
Nate, we've got about 30 seconds here. Anything you want to add?
Well, I would say that just that we have to understand the political context of those kinds of interventions, right? It's easy in the abstract for all of us to say, well, they need to go after disinformation, they need to go after inciting behavior. But when they do that, they're going to be accused of political bias. And because a lot of that content is happening on one side of the political spectrum, they are extremely resistant to get involved in that kind of political and partisan fight.
And that is Nate Persily. He's a professor of law at Stanford Law School, co-director of the Stanford MIT Healthy Elections Project, and director of the Stanford Cyber Policy Center. Also with us, Robin Kaplan, senior researcher at Data and Society. And we are talking about Facebook, about what it is, what it should be, whether it's possible to have some more law and order related to Facebook. Much more after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. Let me just recap, especially if you're just joining us. Facebook whistleblower Frances Haugen testified before the Senate this week about what she described as Facebook's harmful practices. We're talking about what we're learning about the company, its algorithms, its impact on users, and if and whether more oversight, more regulation will force the company to be more responsible about its content. Let me play another clip. This is Frances Haugen from a 60 Minutes interview that aired on Sunday, speaking about Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg.
I have a lot of empathy for Mark. And Mark has never set out to make a hateful platform. But he has allowed choices to be made where the side effects of those choices are that hateful, polarizing content gets more distribution, more reach.
What do you think about that, Nate?
Well, I think it's important to understand the different steps in the argument that she's making, which is that there are, you know, if you prioritize for engagement, then a lot of the engaging content is going to be unhealthy. I tend to think it's a very complicated story there, actually. Facebook is pretty aggressive on policing hate speech, but in today's kind of political climate, there's an enormous amount that gets through the system. And that was one of the disclosures in the document where they basically said that their systems were catching much less than we had thought about on the outside.
I mean, if it is about engagement to you, Robin, and that's their business model, and it clearly works, Is there anything wrong with that? Or is it just some almost like the psychology of engagement leads to these problematic areas we've been talking about?
I think there is definitely something to that. I think that, you know, they obviously have an incentive to try and keep people on their platforms and to keep their platform growing, and that can lead to some of this. But I will also say that Facebook has made many, many changes to their algorithm, and they have defined and redefined what that term engagement means on multiple occasions. And sometimes what ends up happening, and I'm not apologizing for Facebook at all, is that there are some unintended consequences of what they're seeing. So we saw this really in the clickbait era. They were trying to solve for clickbait. They wanted to insert this thing where they could figure out what high quality news was through just looking at people's behaviors around different news articles. They ended up realizing that by defining it in one way, they ended up kind of making things more divisive in the comment sections of articles. By defining it in another way, they decreased heavily traffic that was going into to publishers, which started to destabilize the news media industry. So we start getting this problem when more and more communication is centralized onto these platforms, and when these kind of small tweaks can have these really, really far-reaching effects, especially when it comes to like organizational behavior.
Let me read some comments here. Nate, I'll put this to you. This is from Elizabeth. She said, I recently moved from California near Silicon Valley, and all of the executives at these companies limit their kids' use of social media and screen time because of the detrimental effects on children and how common that knowledge is. Can you speak to that, Nate?
Well, that is true. I mean, as should we all, right? But I'll say for myself as a delinquent parent in this regard, you know, that especially during the pandemic, all the rules on screen use that I had before kind of went out the window. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, that's certainly true that most people who worked in the firms do, you know, restrict and regulate their kids' use of social media.
Let me read a comment from Ray, and I will toss this to you, Robin. Ray says, what about Zuckerberg's response? He denied everything that Haugen said, and I quoted him in my introduction, basically saying that we don't put profits before people. What do you say to that?
I mean, Facebook's problem has been transparency, but it has actually also mostly been honesty. That is what people get really upset about. Most of the stuff that was within these releases are visible to researchers, but we're also visible to the public. When we could see Trump getting special treatment on Facebook, and they continued to deny it. And that is infuriating. So in some research I have done with Tarleton Gillespie, it shows that things like tiered governance, what Facebook was doing with a cross-check program, has actually become an industry standard. And it's not that people mind that there's kind of different rules for different people. They do a bit. They kind of understand it, that this is the way the world works most of the time. But they start getting really angry when they're continually lied to about it. And so that is a major issue, keeps coming up again and again.
Let me just do a quick follow-up just to make sure that our listeners understand what you were just saying there, Robin, which is that certain people using Facebook, and they tend to be, you know, either celebrities or well-known people or rich people, got special treatment.
Yes, they did. So part of the revelations was that there was this program called CrossCheck that Facebook employees could kind of add to at will. And it was putting people kind of on a list where they received less content moderation or weren't moderated at all. And so what these documents really revealed was that what people were expecting was happening was that celebrities and political figures were getting special treatment really was happening behind the scenes.
Here's a comment from Kurt. I'll put this to you, Nate. He says, much of the problem with social media is that they are private corporations. Why not have Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, and others classed as public utilities, which would open them up to greater oversight? What do you think about that?
Well, look, we want them to be private corporations. You don't want the government to be regulating all of, you know, social interaction online, right? So this is part of the challenge. Nevertheless, I wrote a piece in the Washington Post this week and proposed some legislation specifically on the fact that they have lost their right to secrecy, right? That these companies, because of how big they are and how much control they have over the information environment, I think do not have the same rights as other companies in the kind of Citizens United sense, and that they can be regulated in order to be forced to disclose to outside independent research. Let me just say one other thing quickly on the last point that Robin was making, which I agree with, that, the, you know, it is very easy to say that they're putting profits before people and the like, but it's even worse than that in this sense, which is that Facebook, what I see as the big obstacles for them to deal with some of the content moderation are, first, that there is a general kind of libertarian free speech ethos in Silicon Valley, which for much of the world is not the way they think about speech. Second, that they have to think about the effect of their decisions, say, in the U.S. internationally, right? And so to come up with rules that would apply to the entire population of the world is very hard. And then third, their unwillingness to take sides in certain political debates. And so they are extremely allergic to the idea that they have to distinguish between the New York Times and Breitbart, for example, and that general problem of not wanting to take sides is pretty difficult when you have a real imbalance in the information ecosystem like we do now.
Well, let me toss something else on the table. And Robin, earlier this week, Facebook went down something like 6 hours. I mean, for some people, it was an inconvenience. For others, and I think the way it's used in other countries around the world, it was a much more significant problem than that.
Yeah, and I just want to say, Nate, I completely agree with everything you just said. Thank you so much for making all of those points. But right, so Facebook has become infrastructure for much of the world, where they went into many countries and provided this thing called Free Basics, where they actually became the internet for some of the world's population. And then additionally, a lot of the world's population is communicating using WhatsApp, because it is a free tool that doesn't require having minutes or paying for texts on your phone. So we were kind of inconvenienced by Facebook being down, but people elsewhere in the world had no way to contact their family and friends. And even on top of that, there was just so many businesses that are existing on top of these platforms that were no longer able to kind of communicate with their customers anymore. So there is a lot that is now built onto this this platform that goes beyond kind of the major considerations and questions that we're thinking about this week in light of Haugen's testimony.
Let me put something else really wonky on the table, and I'll toss this to you, Nate, personally. This is Section 230, which protects companies, I guess, like Facebook from lawsuits over what users post. This is, I guess we get into what is libelous and what isn't. What do we need to know about Section 230, and is that at issue here?
So Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act doesn't just apply to Facebook, it applies to the whole internet. And so what it says is that platforms that are like social media platforms where they host user content, that the company will not be liable for what is the content that users are producing. It's absolutely critical, it's sort of been a backbone of the internet by fostering the growth of companies like Facebook, Google, but not just them. It also applies to the comments section on the NPR webpage or New York Times and the like. To some extent, but CDA 230 has been the kind of scapegoat for a lot of our problems when it comes to the internet. And so it's become more of a metaphor than it is really about that particular legislation. But you are right, which is what it does is it immunizes these companies and these websites from liability for user speech. And so if you wanted to make them liable for things like defamation or speech that leads to offline harm, then you'd have to amend CDA 230. And there's a lot of suggestions on Capitol Hill on how to do that, a lot of which also might, violate free speech.
Well, how do you police 3 billion people, Nate?
Well, you can't. You can't. And interestingly enough, especially if you're a startup company that's trying to break into this space, you can't. So Facebook, it's impossible for Facebook to know whether every piece of content that goes over the platform is defamatory or not, right? Whether it's sort of falsely insulting someone. And so you'd have to have some kind of rules of how this could be algorithmically enforced. And then when we all know that what ends up happening is that there end up being a lot of false positives. They end up over-censoring when that happens. And in particular, it's vulnerable groups that are often on the receiving end of the increased censorship.
Let me read a comment from Asamina, and then I do want to play one more clip. Asamina says, our culture is incredibly misogynistic and patriarchal, and part of the process of growing up female is getting trained into this culture, which overly sexualizes teenage girls. Social media simply highlights this. We should not be blaming the social media companies. We should be recruiting them to change the thinking about cultural norms around gender. Any just quick response, Robin, to Asamina's comment there?
Yes.
Yes, you agree.
She said it so wonderfully. Yes, absolutely, absolutely. This is a problem that predates social media. This is a problem that's been going on for a very long time. We can take this moment to try and make the world a better place, and that is what we should be doing. But in this particular area, it's hard to place fully the blame on Facebook.
Well, let me play one more comment from Frances Haugen, the Facebook whistleblower, earlier this week, testifying before the Subcommittee on Consumer Protection and talking about the fact that Facebook won't address this problem by itself.
These problems are solvable. A safer, free speech respecting, more enjoyable social media is possible. But there's one thing that I hope everyone takes away from these disclosures. It is that Facebook can change, but is clearly not going to do so on its own.
So, Robin, do you think that we first of all, that we can solve this, but that Facebook will not solve it without some prodding?
I think some of these problems are unsolvable problems. I will be honest there. But I think that Facebook could be doing a lot more than it is doing. There's been multiple calls for Facebook to greatly expand the number of employees that it has that are doing things like trust and safety work. They have added tens of thousands within the last couple of years, but that is not nearly enough for the billions of users and the billions and billions of posts that are being posted to Facebook each day. There are certain ways that they can address the separation between the business side of Facebook and trust and safety teams to give them a little bit more freedom and oversight into how they are doing their work. There needs to be a significant amount more transparency into what is happening at these platforms, more data given to the public, and some of that might need some prodding, yes.
Nate, I'm curious about your answer to that as well, but I was also reading for some people, Facebook is what's used by, you know, old people like me, and that, you know, as we die off, frankly, there'll be something else that will take Facebook's place. Do you think that's true?
Yes, and yes. It's Instagram. And so part of the problem is that Facebook owns the next generation as well as the current one. So, but there's also, you know, experimenting with virtual reality, and Mark Zuckerberg announced, you know, the metaverse. And so there's going to be a lot of movement in that area. But let's also be clear, these problems are not unique to Facebook, right? So all the content moderation issues that Facebook experiences are experienced by Twitter and YouTube and other such platforms. Facebook has just been the out front since 2016, in part because of the revelations about the Russian manipulation of their platform, as well as the Cambridge Analytica scandal. And so they've really been the shield behind which a lot of the other Silicon Valley companies have been huddling. But these content moderation issues apply to any company like this at scale that has a global reach.
Well, Nate, you were talking about more transparency. And Robin, you were talking about, frankly, Facebook being more honest. Sounds like you want to add something, Robin. Go ahead.
Oh, no, I'm just agreeing with Nate. But these are problems that are existing at every single platform company. This is not specific or unique to Facebook.
But and I'll go back to you, Nate. I mean, so do we just live with this or what? Or do we have to just be better, more sophisticated, educated users of all this material and all this social media stuff?
Well, we do need to be more sophisticated users, but the first step to solving this problem is to understand it. And we need Congress to force the social media platforms to subject themselves to outside analysis by independent researchers who are vetted and controlled and to ensure no privacy leakage. Mm-hmm. But only then will we get a sense of the scale of these problems. And we need to, you know, be prepared for the possibility that the answers are going to be different than what conventional wisdom is now suggesting. For example, you know, one the big question coming out of this hearing and others like it is how responsible is the recommendation algorithm or the newsfeed algorithm to promoting and amplifying these problems, right? There's just a fundamental disagreement between critics and Facebook on this. And that is something that only if you have the data that Facebook controls can you figure out the impact of the newsfeed algorithm on hate speech, incitement, child, you know, exploitation, self-harm and the like.
We have to leave it there. Robin, I hear you taking a breath. You have a quick response there. Go ahead.
I do. I think, again, Nate is absolutely correct in what he's saying. We need to prepare for this, maybe not fulfilling our expectations, but we also, platforms are shutting down their access to a lot of researchers right now. That is the major issue now. We're getting less access, not more.
Not more. We got to leave it there. Robin Kaplan, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times. And Nate Persily, thank you for joining us as well.
Thanks for having me back.
You're very welcome. Go to WHYY.org and look for Radio Times under Programs to find out more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show. You can also sign up for our newsletter that comes into your mailbox Sundays at noon. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Marie Bessler. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.
A Kings Island Gold Pass is your ticket to unlimited visits this year and all through 2025. Make the park your own with access to 2 years of tricks and treats, Halloween Haunt, and Winterfest. Plus an expanded Soak City featuring the all-new dual racing water coaster River Racers coming in 2025. All for our lowest price of the season. Just 10 payments of $9 after initial payment plus applicable taxes and fees. Hurry, price goes up September 3rd. Get your Gold Pass at visitkingsisland.com.